Welcome to everybody, and I'm happy that you are here. Some of you I've seen you already in other sessions on climate change, and climate change was a topic which was dealt with, climate change for food and nutrition and security, climate change on sustainability of agriculture, and even decarbonization of traffic has a lot to do with climate change. And the last topic we are now discussing is climate justice for managing climate change risk on health. And as you can see, this has been organized, this session, by two groups. One is the European Academy Science Advisory Council, which is a network of national science academies of the EU member states. And then we have colleagues from the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis in Europe, and this is called the IASA. Is this correct? I hope so.
Yes.
You see it there. So, and this, I was told, is an institute which has been founded and has a location in Austria and is supported from the Austrian, and I think, I don't know, there is a head, he knows much better than I do. Anyway, it is interesting, and I'm happy that these two organizations came together to have this meeting. Well, now I think health is at the center of the discussion, and you probably have all noticed that health has been neglected over the last 20 years. In IPCC reports, you will see that, health was never mentioned, and only recently health has popped up and is an issue, because we as citizens and global citizens will suffer a lot about climate change. And when you think which diseases are really, you know, are associated with climate change, then you will find vector-borne diseases, water-borne diseases, food-borne diseases. You have then non-communicable diseases as cardiovascular diseases, cerebrovascular, respiratory diseases, and including mental health and undernutrition. And of course, groups which are really affected are the elderly, but also young people, also pregnant women. We know that under this tremendous climate change and high temperature, premature babies are born. This is a group which one has to watch. And of course, outdoor workers, for example, are an important group which are affected with climate change. So what we will do today is to discuss this and see what can science contribute to this area. And we will have a number of speakers. This is Robin Fierce. He is the program director from the Bioscience Steering Committee and has done a lot of preparing reports in ESAC on the topic of climate change and health and other topics. And I think we start with Robin, who gives an overview of this issue.
So sorry, the cursor is frozen, so I cannot close these slides and open the other slides. And the lady, the technical help lady, is gone. So, Robin, are you like
stop.
No, I'm fine. No, no, it's frozen. You can't see anything. It doesn't work anything. So, Robin, why don't you take a mic? Why don't you take a mic and we'll find somebody.
I'd always felt that my slides were self-explanatory, but I will try and convey an impression of them for you. But essentially, the first slide was a figure that I think many of you would be familiar with, which essentially was the past and future projections on global warming worldwide. To demonstrate that already has been significant warming worldwide, and of course you all know that. The projections are more uncertain for the future and depend, of course, on what we do to manage greenhouse gas emissions. But I think it's fairly clear now that we will not meet the target of below 1.5 degrees. So yeah, that's obviously a significant issue. The next slide provided an overview of something that Volker had already mentioned, essentially what are the impacts on health. There is already quite a lot of evidence in the literature to demonstrate some of the effects on health, ranging, as Volker said, for infectious disease, mental health, accidents, and so on. The point I was going to make from that is that there are three pathways for the impact of climate on health and issues for climate justice. There are the direct effects, so high temperature and cardiovascular or respiratory disease. There are indirect effects mediated essentially by the environment. So, for example, reduced... reduced agricultural productivity. And the third pathway is also indirect, mediated by socioeconomic factors. So, for example, civil disruption, unemployment, and migration. And clearly these three different pathways intersect and provide a framework for some of the issues that we'll be talking about with regard to health and with regard to justice. So that was one. I hope you agree that I represented it reasonably fairly. That was two, or that will... it takes a while to come. But essentially, these are the direct, indirect impacts on the various aspects of human health. Maria will describe some more detail about this work when she comes to give her presentation. But essentially, we have a large review of the evidence in our ESAP report, which is available, there's paper copies here, but also online on our website. So I'll pass on to that again. I think bringing all that into the context of the World Science Forum this week, there are a number of ethical issues that we will be looking at this morning. This slide just emphasizes the point that many of these ethical issues are at the heart of what we need to do with regard to sustainable development goals, which have been discussed in a number of the sessions this week. There are a number of points highlighted here, but actually were also highlighted in the abstract of the proposal that allowed us to be successful in forming this session. I just want to focus at the moment with regard to the third bullet. For those of you who attended a plenary session earlier this morning, there was a lot of discussion about scientific integrity, quality, relevance, the linkage of that to the objectives for science in terms of informing policy or whatever. So clearly, the issues that we're talking about are much broader and much more pervasive than some of the specific issues for climate, but we will be focusing on climate today in the context of the Sustainable Development Goals. And of course, climate and climate action is relevant to many, probably all of the Sustainable Development Goals. It's not just SDG 13 that's labelled climate action. So it has a very broad framework. This session brings together, as you've heard, two separate groups with mutual interests. ESAC is described there, is formed by the National Science Academies of the EU member states. We have, as Volker already mentioned, as a body, wide interests in climate, for environment, for energy issues, and here for health. And our report on health is on the table over there. EASA, well, as you heard, it is a scientific institute in Austria. The point I want to make, without preempting anybody's presentations, is that actually, apart from our mutual interests, there are common features. Both bodies are not constrained by national, political, or other interests. We are all independent in the advice and the work that we do. That CSAT report, we have also we published this earlier this year. We also have an active publication program in peer-reviewed journals, and we can provide more detail on that as needed. I will leave the content of ESAT work to Maria to talk about later on. Just to note that there are various ethical issues. Obviously, we don't have time or space this morning to consider all of them. I'd just like to focus myself on the one two at the bottom, the implications with regard to planetary health as well as human health or animal health indeed. There are ethical issues with regard, for example, the impacts on intergenerational equity. What we do in this generation clearly influences justice for this generation, but also for the next generation. And finally, in that point, an issue that's come up a number of times in the World Science Forum. One of our responsibilities within the context of ethical science responsibility is to communicate to others, to policymakers, to other stakeholders, and indeed to the public at large. Climate and climate effects is an area bedeviled by a certain amount of misinformation, and sometimes that misinformation comes from vested interests, and we do have a duty as scientists to counter that misinformation. So I will finish my short background, just to leave you with some questions that I hope we can begin to address in our general discussion, obviously together with the questions that you would like to raise. Okay, what do we do about the impacts of climate change that are addressing us today? How can we work together, using the model of this session of scientific groups working together, particularly to convey strong messages that will counter misinformation? How can we work together worldwide? So this is not just a European issue, obviously. And in that worldwide context, how can we, at our country level, ensure that our countries are all doing the best that they can to address the issues that we're talking about in this session. So thank you. I will now hand over to the first speaker from EASA, Sue. Yeah. There will be time for immediate questions after each of you for any resolving technical points, but otherwise we will save the questions for general discussion.
I would say you introduce yourself, okay. Right? Because I never met you, so you would know it much better.
You tried to ring it? Okay.
Yeah, I tried to.
Okay, so on my first slide, you actually see my name, and okay. Therefore I can introduce myself. So my name is Thomas Schinko. I'm economist and system scientist at the International Institute for Applied Systems Analysis. And my research focuses heavily at the moment on climate change related risks that go beyond the limits of adaptation that we are increasingly facing already today. And particularly now with increasing and accelerating climate risks, there's also increasing evidence that we are already reaching adaptation limits in some natural and social systems. And in my talk, I'm now going to explain in a bit more detail in what form we might reach these limits, particularly focusing on health and also on justice questions related to that. So I think this was already nicely presented before, but just to summarize again what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, is finding. It says very conclusively that with increasing temperatures, we will see an increase in the frequency and intensity of extreme weather and climate-related events. This comprises floods, droughts, heat waves. And we already see today that climate change is loading the dice, is altering these extreme events. And many of the observed risks, impacts since the 1950s can now be causally linked already to climate change. So climate attribution science is identifying fingerprints of human interference in these events. But what does that mean for the future? You might have seen and come across this iconic figure from the IPCC reports, the five reasons for concern, which I believe show quite nicely where we are heading at. And the five reasons for concern comprise extreme weather events, so starting from the RFC1, unique and threatened systems, ecosystems, extreme weather events, distributional impacts, global aggregate impacts, and large-scale singular events. And when you look at this grayish bar, this shows where we are now. This is the already observed global warming compared to pre-industrial levels, and we are already close to 1 degree. And the color shading, going from white to purple, is showing the level of additional impacts or risk due to climate change. So this goes from white, where there's no climate change fingerprint being detectable, all the way up to very high. This is the purple area, and this shows where we might even face adaptation limits. And as said already today, for some of these reasons for concern, particularly RFC 1 and 2, we already see moderate increases of risk due to climate change. If we then move upwards towards the Paris Agreement's goal, which is between 1.5 and 2 degrees, so even if we reach that goal, we might end up in a situation where high or even very high additional risk is being imposed. And what we also see that the Paris pledges, the voluntary pledges that have been made by individual countries will not be enough to really safeguard us under this 2 degree target. It will lead to something like 2.6, 3.1 degrees. And this, indicated by these arrows that I added to this IPCC figure, shows that we might experience even higher risks in the future. So to deal with these impacts beyond adaptation, a third pillar of international climate policy got introduced in 2013. This third pillar is called loss and damage, and this is in addition to climate change mitigation and adaptation. So these two policy domains I'm pretty sure you're familiar with, but in many occasions when I give these kind of presentations, people have not heard of loss and damage. And it's kind of new, but the debate dates back to 1991 already, so to the very beginnings of the UNFCCC, to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. And this is when the Alliance of Small Island States, the EOSIS, started to emphasize that there will be impacts from climate change on the most vulnerable countries, and they also suggested a compensation mechanism. But it really took until 2013 that this new policy domain got institutionalized under the Warsaw International Mechanism on Loss and Damage. And in 2015, with the Paris Agreement, loss and damage got its own article, Article 8 of the Paris Agreement. Working groups have been started under this Warsaw International Mechanism, for example, on displacement, non-economic losses, because many of these impacts beyond adaptation are not quantifiable. It's about losses, cultural losses, it's about language losses, loss of land, ancestral land. So there's a lot of discussion going on about this non-economic impacts. And there's also a working group on comprehensive and transformational risk management, and colleagues from IASA are also part of this discourse and of this working group. And last but not least, Loss and Damage Network, also the research community got interested in this topic, and together with some colleagues, including Joanne Bayer and Reinhard Melcher, colleagues from IASA, we started the Loss and Damage Network. This is a group of people, of researchers, practitioners from all over the world that came together and identified a need for more scientific, objective input into this policy discourse. And one of the first milestone outputs was the book, Loss and Damage from Climate Change, that we would say is the first comprehensive stocktake on climate, or on actually interdisciplinary research focusing on the topic of loss and damage. It's open access, you can all download it, and we can be a bit proud of it. We already have almost 200,000 downloads of this book, and this shows that this topic is really a hot topic in the not only research community but also in the policy discourse. So I've been talking about limits to adaptation. Where might these limits arise? There was the recent IPCC report on 1.5 degrees of global warming, and this IPCC report for the first time also showed some potential limits to adaptation. And this table gives an overview of certain sectors where we might experience soft and hard adaptation limits in the context of 1.5 degree and 2 degrees of global warming. Due to time restrictions and also the focus of our session, I also want to focus on the health section here. And the IPCC report finds that twice as many megacities will be exposed to heat stress at 1.5 degree compared to present, and this would translate into potentially exposing 350 million additional people to deadly heat wave conditions by 2050. And this is with quite some likelihood. There's even a separate chapter on this, so you can look further into the details of this report. And I'm pretty sure that many of you have come across this recent publication that came out a couple of weeks ago, and I just took a screenshot of the Guardian headline. And this report by the Lancet Commission on Climate Change and Health shows quite nicely how the ongoing climate crisis affects health all over the world. And this report particularly identified elderly and children as the most vulnerable parts of society. So why children, why elderly people? The global team of researchers found or argues that with rising temperatures, there will be, for example, additional crop losses, and this might lead to malnutrition and child stunting. In addition, there might be, due to the increasing temperatures, bacteria that could cause deadly diarrhea, for example, heavily impacting the youngest of our societies. The older people, above 65, for example, they are very vulnerable to heat waves. This is because older people are not as capable of regulating their fluid balance, and this is why particularly poor and also the particularly poor parts of society are exposed to these risks. And the report concludes that with increasing levels of global warming, these risks will even increase in the future on health. But I think in the later sessions and presentations, we will hear a bit more details on that. So it has been mainly global south countries that have been at the center of the discourse. But here I want to show that also countries of the global north, industrialized countries like Austria, where I'm coming from, we will experience severe climate change-related impacts on health as well. And the Austrian counterpart to the IPCC, the APCC, has recently published a report on climate change and health. And we found that also in Austria, the most severe and far-reaching effects will be health impacts due to heat. There will also be change in ecosystems, and these will threaten health via the distribution, frequency types, and severity of pollen allergies and vector-borne infectious diseases being changed. And also we will see altered patterns of precipitation and storms with all the negative impacts. And also the impacts are very unevenly distributed, even in a country like Austria. So we see that health impacts on older people are more susceptible to extreme heat, and migrants, that's also a finding of this report, with lower socioeconomic resources experience reduced adaptive capacity. So this should give you some insight that also in temperate regions where one would not expect such heavy impacts of climate change on health, we do see some evidence. And now I want to focus a bit on the ethics considerations for tackling climate change. And over the years in the climate policy discourse, we have seen that the ethical discourse has mainly been centering on the distributive justice aspects. In climate change mitigation, it was about how do we distribute fairly the greenhouse gas emission burdens across countries and across generations. And in the climate change adaptation context, it was mainly about the fair distribution of costs and benefits of adaptation costs across actors today and in the future. So we see that we always have this inter and intra-generational justice aspects. But now with this limits to adaptation discourse popping up, particularly in the loss and damage discourse, there has been another element added to the justice debate, and this is compensatory justice. So here I want to highlight what is actually the elephant in the room of these negotiations where we are also sometimes part of. It is about these questions. Are rich countries of the global north liable for current and future losses and damages in the countries of the global south due to their large contributions to historical greenhouse gas emissions? So this is really the core question in this loss and damage debates. It is never being concretely announced there, but you can always feel it swinging along in the background. And if the answer would be yes, are they responsible for compensatory payments to the global south countries? So this is really the ongoing hot compensatory justice debate in the domain when we talk about impacts beyond adaptation. And also, my last slide, I want to focus on what do these adaptation measures look like in reality. And one thing that became also very clear from the IPCC report is that with increasing levels of global warming, business as usual will not be enough. We need to do more than what we have done in terms of improving irrigation system, for example, in terms of building up physical infrastructure. We need to move towards more transformative changes, and this could involve thinking about completely alternative livelihoods. So for farmers, for example, that focused on crop farming, they might change to livestock farming. They might change to tourism overall. Also, this means completely new ideas for city planning. And also there's some justice discourse, of course, going on. Who is going to say this is transformational? Is it us researchers sitting here in the global north, or do we have to engage much more in a participatory research way with people who are actually vulnerable and exposed to these risks? And with that, I would stop here, and I'm looking forward to discussion later on.
Well, are there questions for him already? Yeah.
So, well, thank you very much for the nice overview. I really liked it. One thing what I noticed that you are focusing on, that's health, but it's human health. Since I'm a veterinarian, I very much would like to, and maybe perhaps there would be opportunities to include the health of animals as well, the climate change on animal health, wildlife, that could be source of so many diseases, infectious diseases, influence on human well-being, and actually the ecosystem, but so many other things. I don't know whether you thought about that.
So I personally did not, because I'm not a veterinarian, but I can. The report that I presented from Austria, it doesn't work anymore, but the report on health and climate change, this was a special report, but there's also a more broad report by the Austrian Panel on Climate Change that focuses on all different potential impact categories and effects of climate change, and there agriculture, livestock played a big role as well. And we are currently developing a new report on land use change, agriculture, and I'm pretty sure that we will also touch on that. So it is being considered by colleagues who know what they're doing.
Let me ask you a question to your interesting document on loss and damage. And you said in your ending that the rich countries, you know, should actually compensate for what they did with so much CO2 putting into the air. You know that there is a discussion going in particular among young people, and for example, my children told me that if you now travel by airplane, you should pay a certain amount of money to a certain organization and they will plant trees. Now, in your document, did you come up with some suggestions? What should be done with the money? Let's say the rich countries, you know, will pay. Will this then be used, you know, to reduce climate change? Or what is there any strange text attention? Yeah.
Well, Actually, this leads over to the next speaker, I think, because my colleague Joanne will talk about a certain mechanism, insurance, as a potential idea to operationalize the loss and damage discourse in reality. But there is no solution being found already. So the whole policy discourse is still very vague. It's not palpable that we will find a solution soon. But there are different, I mean, there are not even clear estimates how much this loss and damages will be. It also depends on which method you apply to find some estimates for that. And here we are doing at YASO risk-based research, for example, where we really focus on these extreme events. And this is a completely different result than if you compare it only to average-based assessments. But in a nutshell, there is no conclusion at the moment what could be done. The most prominent suggestions are circling around insurance systems.
Since you are a young economist, and economists have all great ideas, do you have any suggestion? So what would you like to see?
The first suggestion that I would have is that we should move the ethical, the justice discourse, away from this compensatory justice discourse, because I see it in the negotiation that this is not moving the discourse any further. So what we suggest also in our book is that we link this compensatory justice debate with a distributive justice debate. So, and at least for the shorter term, where rich countries like the US and others are still really pushing back on any payments being made to the global south, because they have huge concerns about liability claims in the future, endless liability claims. So we would say, let's rather focus on a distributive justice aspect, see who is really in need of support, financial support even, and then on a resource basis also look which countries could afford it. And this could maybe circle around an insurance scheme, but I don't think it makes a lot of sense if we now really continue this blockage in the debate in terms of compensation.
So I will not preempt it. Thanks, Thomas, and we will discuss this further when we have a panel discussion. So the next will be by a lady. We keep the gender, you know, in proportion. And this is Dr. Johanna Unterroth-Bayer, also from Austria, from the same institute, and we are looking for your presentation.
Thank you very much. There we go. Okay. Yeah. Yes, thank you. I will not spend time too much on myself. I have been a long time person at the YASA, and I'm very pleased that I had two good talks before mine, one talking more about the relationship with climate change.
Sorry, I guess I should be using this over here. Okay, this is better. The relationship between climate and health. So I won't spend so much time on that. I think we saw that there's a huge connection. Also, thank you very much, Thomas, for setting out the kind of broad platform on the problematic of adaptation, of how much can we actually adapt to, meaning actually reduce things to where they're actually acceptable, and what is beyond that, and how are we going to deal with that, and do we need some transformational mechanisms? And I would like to take that broad discussion now down to funnel it down to talk about climate extremes as being only one actually impact of climate change, its relationship to health, where I won't say too much because we've already had a lot of introduction to that, and talk about the insurance mechanism and how insurance could form a kind of tool for addressing loss and damage. After all, loss and damage is a terminology out of insurance. And how can we, in fact, shape insurance programs that might address this? So, first, I don't think I probably need to convince this audience that climate extremes are serious. What we're seeing all across the globe for all kinds of disasters, meaning technological and so-called natural, around 90,000 fatalities worldwide. And the economic losses over $150 billion, and of course increasing because of climate change. About half of those are insured. And probably you don't know in this audience too much about insurance, but it is a huge industry. If you look at life and non-life insurance worldwide, premiums this year topped the $5 trillion mark. That's 6% of global GDP. So we're not talking about a small industry. We're talking about a major industry in this globe that is really set up to share losses. And so if I move from there, you know, we are talking a lot about climate-related disasters, which have accounted for about 80% of the major disasters, most being floods and storms. My focus will be on the developing world. And developing countries are disproportionately affected by climate extremes. People in poorer nations are 7 times more likely to be killed by a disaster than in wealthier ones. And the economic losses economic losses are obviously higher in the developed world. But in terms of GNP, they're disproportionately serious in the developing countries. Health impacts, examples. I don't need to spend time on this. We've already heard a lot about it, but I just go through my list here. Of course, we have heat-related mortality. We have drought-related famine and malnutrition, focusing again on the developing world. We have flood-related diseases from water contamination, but mold that is in the houses afterwards, sewage backup leading to, as Thomas was saying, diarrheal diseases and so on. We have land mudslide-related illnesses due to damaged property and consequent substandard living conditions. And maybe most importantly, if we're talking about the developing world, we're finding that disasters are really trapping households, farmers, in poverty. Poverty is, of course, not good for your health. I'll say more about this in my next slide, where I'm asking, actually, how do the poor cope with climate extremes? And I draw your attention particularly to the selling of livestock. Selling of livestock or other productive activities. Oh, by the way, this is a survey we did in Uganda, and in rural Uganda, so we're talking mainly about farmers here. And selling livestock or any kind of productive asset is really a very typical response, and that itself traps these people in poverty. They can't kind of move forward because these disasters keep knocking them 2 steps back. Of course, also reducing their expenditures also on food. Of course, that's where you get into the malnutrition, the child stunting, and so on. Very serious health impacts. And then we see a range of other very worrying responses, like taking their children out of school, putting their children to work, and other more or less worrying ways the poor cope. I also draw your attention here that you don't see these people saying, I depend on my government. It comes in with relief. That's the big issue. The governments in these countries are also crippled after major disasters and cannot provide the relief, or they're corrupt and do not provide relief. And what else don't you see? You also don't see on that pie chart anybody saying they're insured, right? And so because of that, there has been, only 1.4% of losses in Africa are actually covered by insurance. This is in a survey was done in Africa, compared to 42% in the U.S. or 34% in Europe. So very, very minimal insurance coverage for extremes, for catastrophic types of losses. So because of that, it's probably not surprising that insurance has received huge attention for climate adaptation and also coping with loss and damage. And we're talking about the developing world, we're generally talking about 2 major classes of insurance. One is direct insurance to households or farmers. It's called microinsurance for the poor. At this moment, there's over 200 pilot projects experimenting with this. And recently, the G7 drew a lot of headlines with their initiative called Insure Resilience, which aims to increase climate insurance access for up to 400 million of the most vulnerable people by 2020. We'll see if they manage that. Another major class of insurance is actually to insure governments. And governments are actually forming risk pools. One example is the African Risk Capacity Facility, which operates an awful much like, if any of you are familiar with it, of the EU Solidarity Fund, where if one country experiences a major disaster, this pool will come in and support support the country. So kind of what we call sovereign insurance for governments, micro insurance for people. And so why insurance? What are the benefits of insurance? Well, of course, providing those safety nets so you can feed your children after a disaster and put the roof back on your house. Also, it's very, very hyped, particularly in the insurance industry, that farmers, where a lot of these microinsurance companies are mainly for farmers, they can take higher risk, higher yield strategies, so they can actually make themselves more productive with insurance. And also, if you've designed these policies properly, you can also build in incentives for actually reducing their risks. What's given less attention to, we're here all over the place about the benefits, what's given less attention to are the costs. And I just want, you know, I this has been kind of my soapbox. I want to make sure people understand that insurance is a very costly operation, not only for us when we insure our cars, but particularly for catastrophic events. Because insurers have to hold huge amounts of capital or reinsure, that's very expensive. That gets passed down to the premium. There's many other things that get passed down into the premium, what we call loading the premium, which I don't have time to go into, but I should point out that the premium for catastrophe insurance, can be up to 500% or five times as high as your as the person's or the farmer's expected losses. So if you're insuring the vulnerable in poor countries, you have to realize that they're paying a lot more than they expect to lose. And I think that gives us some take on, is this really a fair mechanism for dealing with loss and damage? So let me move a little bit into that. And talk about insurance and equity. Thank you, Thomas, for bringing up your ideas of compensatory and distributive justice. And I would like to build on that, looking at insurance instruments. So first, there are three principles that could be called upon for building an insurance system, both a private insurance system or a public insurance system. And many of you are probably familiar with health insurance more than this, so you might want to, you know, connect with health insurance as I go through this. First is mutuality. Mutuality is, in fact, the principle behind commercial or market-based insurance. It means that the insured pay premiums according to their risk class, yeah, and what we call risk-based premium. And as I just said, insurance payments are going to be significantly greater than your expected losses with a mutuality type of system, which is all commercial insurance, is based on mutuality. We also have, and Thomas mentioned this, we also can bring in a lot of solidarity into insurance systems. Most health insurance programs have huge solidarity. What does that mean? Well, it means that premiums may be paid according to your ability to pay, they may just be equal, but they're not necessarily related to your risk. Yeah, and that means generally that those in low-risk people may be paying, cross-subsidizing those people who are in high risk. That's what we call a kind of solidarity insurance system. And as Thomas brought up, the discourse, the narrative is moving into another principle when it comes to insuring the poor and vulnerable for climate extremes. And that, we might call that compensatory justice, is what Thomas was talking about. I'm calling it accountability, which means that premiums are at least partly paid by those responsible for the risks based on some kind of causation. Often we think of fault or negligence. You know, the principle behind this, or what's behind the principle, is that there can be claims of ethical or legal obligation for compensating those experiencing climate-attributed losses and damages. Exactly what Thomas was saying about compensatory justice, and where is this narrative actually going? So if I go back and look at each of these principles, each one is problematic in a different way. First, with mutuality, we have to ask, you know, is that actually affordable? Also, is that actually fair? Should you put the burden on the farmer when some of that risk may be attributed to what we have done in the global north? Okay, with solidarity, This may probably will surprise you, but there's an increasing narrative among in the developing country that they do not want to hear this term solidarity. Why don't they want to hear it? Because it rings of charity. Oh, these are the nice guys up there helping us out. They're contributing to our premiums. Aren't they nice? They want to change that to say, no, they're the bad guys. They've imposed these risks on us, and they should be contributing. They should be now paying for these losses, paying for this loss and damage. So the solidarity narrative is in some quarters being discredited. Accountability, well, you know, as much as we have said it before, compensatory justice, it's actually been rejected. In the Paris Agreement, for instance, it explicitly says that they will not, you know, entertain anything about compensation or liability for loss and damage. So it has been ruled out as a legitimate discourse in the climate negotiations. So, you know, we have these issues with insurance. Okay, I don't probably have enough time to go through two examples. I'm looking if I could, if I go really fast through them. I mean, just to bring this down to home to what's actually going on out there. An example of an insurance program based on solidarity is what's called this R4 program in Africa, which is now a drought insurance. Now 40,000 smallholder farmers are insured. Instead of paying premiums, farmers work on disaster risk reduction projects. It is subsidized heavily by donors. Solidarity. Now they're moving, and this is very interesting because this is the first example that's kind of emerged where accountability or compensatory justice may be behind it. And I've mentioned this ARC pool in Africa. And members of this ARC pool, country members, government members, can actually receive additional financing based on the payments to them will depend on extreme events over a 30-year period. If there is a significant increase, which meaning from climate change, they will receive an additional payment financed by northern countries. So the northern countries will be charged for their attribution into this ARC, and so you know they would have every incentive to make sure this doesn't happen because it's actually going to cost them a whole lot. And the countries who receive these payments must use them to invest in disaster risk reduction. So that's the first time that we're kind of seeing an insurance instrument being kind of shaped into a compensatory mechanism. And I should pause here because this is really important, I think, that we have been lobbying very hard. What's called the Munich Climate Insurance Initiative, to shape a global insurance mechanism that would build in compensation without using the term. So if you actually compensate countries and say, well, it's based, you know, that they have no premium, so it's an insurance mechanism. So you say insurance mechanism and not compensation mechanism, and it really builds into what Thomas was just saying. Let's not go there with compensation. It's not going to get us anywhere, I can tell you. I've been trying it for 15 years. But you can shape what's on the table, insurance, and have a lot of very subtle compensatory mechanisms in it. So I think, let me go. Final slide is just my messages. Insurance can provide critical safety nets and disaster risk reduction benefits to poor communities and is a potential mechanism for addressing loss and damage. For the most vulnerable, affordability is a challenge for commercial insurance based on mutuality. Most insurance programs in the developing world are based on donor solidarity, but as I mentioned earlier, that's controversial. And the narrative may be changing to support based on the principle of accountability. And I just posed this question, can this be an alternative to legal liability and compensation? So, thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm always amazed about the fantasy of economists when it comes to insurance, what can be done. I'm a medic.
You're what?
I'm a medic. I'm a physician.
You're a physician, okay.
And so I'm amazed that the topic, you know, of health insurance, of doing something for these poor people with all the infectious diseases and they're coming up. There wouldn't be idea to have some sort of a simple health insurance when they get sick, or to create health centers in these areas where they can be treated?
I think that this could be very, very much complementary with health insurance. I mean, today, I have property insurance, and I also have health insurance. So I'm talking about a subset of issues. I'm also not talking only about health. These insurance systems that we're talking about, this will give you some funding to feed your children. This will give you funding to put your roof on your house. It will give you funding to get over the drought. Yeah. So it has implications for health. But I think in addition to that, we need to address health insurance, which has another subset of issues.
Any other burning questions? Otherwise, we discuss it. When, yeah, please. Wait.
I just want to say about the insurance in Indonesia, especially for the farmers. The government pays 70% for the subsidy.
Subsidy for what?
Insurance.
Which kind of insurance?
For farmers, yeah.
For disaster insurance?
Yeah. I can say, like crop failure.
Crop, okay.
Yeah. It is 70%, but it's not success. I mean, the success only in the several areas. It's difficult to farmer to pay the 30%.
I haven't gotten into details because it hasn't been time, but there are two different types of crop insurance. One is a kind of index-based insurance, mm-hmm. and one is just the normal annuity-based insurance. And usually crop insurance across the world is heavily subsidized. And it's a big issue right now in Europe because the European Union is just coming out and saying we should start providing heavily subsidized drought insurance, 50% actually. And in Austria now, insurance, drought insurance is subsidized 50%, not the 75% that you're talking about, which for very poor countries makes a lot of sense. It's not clear it makes a lot of sense for wealthy countries. The US has been providing very subsidized crop insurance for years and years, and it's led to a lot of very negative environmental effects. Another topic, but yeah, I'm very much for subsidies when it's, you know, for the poor. I should say that we've had a lot of pushback on that. Like the World Bank for quite some time was saying, don't subsidize any insurance. Also this G7 initiative I just talked about, in the beginning, no subsidies. It was going to be completely commercialized market insurance. And actually we've come in from this Verein I'm a part of and have really promoted the idea of subsidies. And now it is actually being subsidized, the G7. So I think it's a battle we've won. Even though we would probably not have the same recommendation for Austria.
Okay, yeah. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, and we will discuss this later. So the last speaker will be Professor Nielsen from the Department of Epidemiology and Global Health from the University of Umeå. She was a member of our working group, which prepared this report, which is there on the table. Mm-hmm. And Ria, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. Really nice to be here, and I would like to speak a bit about vulnerabilities. But before starting to line up some examples of that, I just want to touch a bit. Okay, see that way. Okay. I just want to touch a bit about what's in the report, the ESAC report. There are many risk pathways that leads to health impacts, both directly and indirectly. And in the report, we cover infectious diseases, non-communicable diseases. We also include mental health impacts, injuries and traumas, and also health outcomes when it comes to hazardous algal bloom, undernutrition. I mean, it's a huge report, so please have a copy before you leave and go through those different health impacts. I mean, we really need to look into those who are most vulnerable, because climate change actually impacts in different ways to different regions, in different locations, but also impacting population groups in different ways, where some are more vulnerable than others. Climate change already contributes to premature death, also in Europe. And when we published this report in June, I was quite surprised by the media coverage. And in some sense, I also felt that this is because that people starting to understand that we see it already happening here in Europe. And I think it's quite human also that you try to keep the effects far away from you, because it's complex, it's difficult to understand. And many of the people I've met in Europe who are not researchers themselves talk about it that as something that is distant. It's not about us. But when you suddenly see and you go through those reports and the results that's covered, you start to understand it is about us here and now. So, talking about parts of the world that are more sensitive to and more vulnerable, of course, Africa, the Arctic, where I live, small island states are particularly sensitive to the climate change. And also, it is, but the region, the continent in the world that is most vulnerable today is, of course, Africa, but that is also because of other stressors that are there, and also a low adaptive capacity. So this is, of course, very important to put into the big picture. But being here today, it's about Europe, so I will go into that. And impacts of climate change also intersect with other societal changes, such as urbanization, population aging, so this is also important to consider. Individuals may be vulnerable because of individual particular sensitivity, of course, but it's also because of as I said earlier, where you live in the world, but also if you have other systems that fail or are weak, that you have inadequate health systems or other social system or problems with the infrastructure. Among those most vulnerable, as mentioned earlier, you find the elderly, infants and small children, pregnant women, outdoor workers. I mean, if you work outdoor, heavy labor, in a hotter climate, of course, that may come to a level where it actually is very, very dangerous to your health. We also have the migrants, poor people with also less means to adapt, and also people with pre-existing diseases. The magnitude of the problem of the health effects depends on the nature of the hazard, the exposure to the hazard, and then also to the individual vulnerability. Those who are already vulnerable may actually be more susceptible to relatively small changes in climate conditions. I will give a few concrete examples of vulnerabilities. I mean, this is a conference about science, ethics, and responsibility. So focusing on those who need protection to not harm the health is, of course, of central value on this conference. Heat waves and cold spells are associated with premature mortality and morbidity, and then very much from cardiovascular disease, from respiratory disease and cerebrovascular disease. On extra hot days, then there is a risk also for other groups, I mean, it's not only about the elderly, but it's also, we found in research, on extra hot days, it can actually go down also to a younger population than the elderly. Among the groups who are particularly susceptible then to heat, again, are the elderly, but also the infants, as mentioned earlier by one of the early speakers. Young children, also those who are having a pre-existing disease, NCDs, and those in hospitals, nursing homes, people who are bedridden. For the pregnant mothers then, and also for the fetus, unusually high temperatures, and temperature exposure affects a range of birth outcomes that also may be harmful, including length of gestation, neonatal stress, birth weight, stillbirth. And this significantly increased risk of dying is also reported in connection to mental health and diseases, disorders like depression, but also other mental health disorders. And this may be because of medication, because at high temperatures, medication with diuretics, but also psychotropic drugs, may be increased with an increased risk of mortality and morbidity. And then again, especially in the elderly who have mental disorders. City dwellers are exposed to higher risks also and heat stress because of urban heat island effects. And this increased vulnerabilities in those groups I've talked about many times. The urban heat island effect is an effect you see in densely populated areas. And that is when it's warmer than in the surrounding areas. And this is also due to effects from physical structure, but also building materials. And the building materials may store heat during day that emits during night. And this is, of course, if you are already vulnerable, something that may threaten your health and even your life. The main effects from flood events, from flooding, are cardiovascular diseases, injuries, infections, exposures to chemical substances, and then also mental health consequences. The associated disruption of services, including the health services, is a problem there. And also safe drinking water, sanitation, and also transport may increase the existing vulnerabilities. And then also factors in the indoor environment may be impacted and impact health. You can see that the temperature and air quality may be impacted if we get increased precipitation, heavy rainfalls, and water damage and dampness in buildings may become more common because of increased precipitation, but also flood events. An indoor environment that is hot and humid may also increase the risk of moisture-related occurrence of mold, and higher concentrations of chemical substances. Again, older people are vulnerable here, and especially those who live alone. We've seen that people also have allergies and asthma, of course, are impacted, and those who have socioeconomic vulnerabilities. The greater susceptibility of the elderly can be explained, as also was touched upon earlier, by their lower physiological reserve capacity, a slower immune system and metabolism. The cardiovascular and the central nervous systems are at particular risk. Vulnerability in the elderly may also be because of the poor physical health, of course, and the medications, and also due to an underestimation of the heat-related risks, that you yourself don't understand actually how harmful it can be, but also maybe those around you, your relatives or the people that take care of you, for example, in a nursing home or elsewhere. Climate change impacts then the health of children. Also, as mentioned before, we can see many different types of impacts, and the children are vulnerable because they have a different behavior that may expose them to other types of risks. They are not in control of the environment in which they live. They also depend on care and protection from adults. So there are several reasons also combined with their bodies responding differently to exposures. Through adolescence and into adulthood, children will be exposed to toxic air. And this is, of course, a very big problem. Breathing toxic air from fossil fuel burning. And this may also be worsened by increasing temperatures. This is especially damaging for young people because of the development of, the lungs are still developing, so this is a bigger risk for those. So polluted air takes a great toll and contributes to reduce lung function, worsening asthma, and over time increased risks also for heart attacks and stroke. Ahead of them, children have a lifetime of exposure to potential harms. So climate change challenges the very core, I would say, of children's right to survival, to good health, well-being, nutritious food, and also education, in accordance with the Convention on Children's Rights, and also which is emphasized in the SDGs. So we have a great responsibility for the children. And that is also why in the Lancet Countdown report, this was the framing of the stories told and the research done. We sort of have to look climate change in the eyes and understand the impacts. And I'm quite sure that for all of us, health is important. When we ask somebody what is important in your life, most of the people say, yes, health is. And it's as also you touched upon, poverty. I mean, if you are not healthy, then of course it's very difficult to change your life situation for yourself and for your family. The protection of health and the most vulnerable must have a much higher profile in the policies aimed at mitigation and adaptation to the effects of climate change. We have already talked about ethical perspectives, ethical issues during this session, but I will just end by putting up a few more ethical problems or issues to consider. And some of them have been touched upon already, that the most vulnerable countries and people are those who have emitted the least historically. And we have to face that. That's the story. So each one of us, of course, have to think about how to deal with that. And also those whose emission levels continue to be relatively low. And the current emissions have profound intergenerational effects. So children rightly asks for answers and solutions. Emissions of carbon dioxide typically persist in the atmosphere for long, according to IPCC, contributing to negative climate impacts for centuries, if not millennia. Climate change adds to an extra burden to those who are already most vulnerable, And of course, that's about ethics. What do we do about that? And with that, I leave to you to continue the discussion. Thank you.
I would like that all speakers take a seat there, so that we then can continue the discussion and you can ask your questions. Maria, I think you have done very nice wrap-up about the interaction of climate change and health. Are there questions? Yeah. Oh, yes. All right. Start. Sorry. Yeah.
Good morning.
Okay, I can only report from a little bit different setting from Austria, where we are experimenting with I would say quite novel research methods. So we are developing role play simulations where we bring together decision makers, policy makers with the people actually affected in regions. So in Austria, for example, we are facing problems related to forestry sectors, agricultural sectors. So there are really existential risks that whole forests are dying off due to the bark beetle problem, or it's getting too warm and droughts are increasing. And we also saw that there are options on the table, but they are maybe not being taken. And one reason is because there's this disconnect between policy and implementation. And we thought, okay, it might be a good way to bring these together, these different stakeholders. And in this role play simulations, a mayor, for example, has to take on the role of a farmer. So they don't play their own role, but a different role. And our experience showed that the mutual understanding really increased afterwards. So mayors became way more apparent what is going on. But on the other hand, the farmers themselves realized, okay, there's only so much a mayor can do, and then you have to go to a different governance level. So we are only starting with this kind of research, but I'm personally getting interested into that because I'm also seeing that, particularly in climate science, we have been doing this kind of research for a long time, and not too much has happened. And this could bring it down to earth.
It's a very important question you raise, and if I had the answer, I would be really happy, of course. Yeah. What I try to do as a researcher is that I work together with decision makers in every project I work with. And I put them, they are part of the project from the start. So they understand the questions raised, they have a chance to discuss difficulties, potential negative impacts for the population, but also for themselves maybe as a politician. Because if this is known, they will also have to take the responsibility. And I have a few examples. I had a doctoral student in Costa Rica, and she worked with sugarcane harvesters and the impact from heat. And there we had a constant dialogue with the government. So actually by the end of the project, when she presented the results, it also resulted in improved policies to protect workers. So that was also one concrete example. In Indonesia, I work with a warning system for dengue fever. And there, actually, the mayor did not want us to do that. He did not want us to be transparent about dengue being endemic there. But we have continued the dialogue and made sure that we try to be on good speaking terms. And we have also asked him about how we can find solutions. And now after, let me see, it's 5 years, they have agreed to go out with a warning system, web-based and also through apps. So the transparency that he did not want is actually there now. So I think that is important as a researcher, that I make sure that I already from the start work together with those who make the decisions.
Should we keep on this one? Okay. yes, I think, you know, we've done some work also in the Caribbean and also with hurricanes. And, of course, our first line of defense needs to be to prevent the destruction from the hurricanes. And we've failed miserably. I think, you know, the Sindai framework brought it up, but if you look at the statistics, practically all the funding going into disasters is responding to them. It is not preventing them. It's like 90% to 10%. So, you know, making policymakers sensitive to this is a fantastic idea. I also don't have the answers, but it's really urgent. But the field we've been working in is the adaptation and how do you actually respond. And the mental health issues you're talking about, you know, this is that we have to ask, why did it take so long in Puerto Rico or all these countries that have been hit to actually get back to normal? You know, I mean, if they can ever really get back to normal, but at least to have a normal lifestyle again. And that's where we've been coming in. And there is, for instance, this Caribbean Fund, CRIF, where all the countries have pooled together. But what we're finding is that support goes mainly to the big hotels and the infrastructure after disasters. So you're saying, what? How do we get it to the most vulnerable? I think we have to start looking. Where has it worked? We're looking closely at this African facility, which I was talking about. There is a requirement there that they have to give a plan for when they get support into the government, you know, which is triggered by such a disaster. They have to say how they get it to the most vulnerable and quickly. And that has not been tested yet. We'll see if it works. The plan is there. But exactly what you said. I'm amazed when you talk to policymakers in Africa who are part of this, how sensitive they are now to the fact we've got to get help out there and fast.
Okay.
Because it is a core question to all that we're discussing. When ESAC first started engaging with the European Commission before we started our project to understand their perspectives and issues with regard to climate impacts on health, there was actually rather little recognition that it was an issue. It was kind of new to the European Union thinking about climate change, but health was potentially a major issue. That has changed in the last couple of years. I don't think it's entirely due to the ESAT work, but it is beginning to change, that there is more political visibility. So, for example, some of you will know very well the work of a group of chief scientific advisors for the European Commission, and they will be preparing an opinion next year, partly based on the ESAC work. I think one of the issues is that it's still seen as a sectoral priority. That is, how can a health sector adapt to these issues? That there's still a lot more to be done to drive joined-up policy across departments. And again, in the days when climate problems were thought of problems for someone else, not for us in Europe, it was seen as, for example, a development issue rather than an issue for European priorities for our own agriculture or health systems. I think, just to finish, that there is a continuing problem, not just with the policymakers, but with the public at large. Health is a value for everyone, and health issues are obviously a great concern to us all. It's still, in Europe, seen somewhat in the context of it's a problem for others. You know, it's a nice warm day, what's the problem? And that issue is compounded, as I mentioned originally, by vested interests who try to deny that there is an issue at all. I suppose I can just mention one. In the context of continuing the theme that we've been discussing in other sessions over the last couple of days, one of the, as it were, the indirect impacts of climate on health is mediated through agriculture, food and nutrition. So that climate change affects agriculture in negative ways, and agriculture also contributes to climate change. So anything that can be done to mitigate, to reduce that contribution to greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture will help broadly on climate change. And also, if we can develop climate resilient agriculture, then we will be in a better position to adapt to the climate change that's already occurred. So there are opportunities to use technology in agriculture both to mitigate and to adapt. One of those examples, controversial example, but we have discussed over the last couple of days, is the range of emerging technologies based on genomics for plant and animal breeding. And we could have a long discussion about that. But there is a scientific opportunity, obviously up to society and the regulators and the policymakers, how to capitalise on that opportunity. But there is the scientific advances are underpinning the potential to use emerging technologies in the biosciences. Okay.
Thank you for puzzling us. I would put a candidate up there in the area that I've been talking about for insurance systems. There is insurance systems where if the soil moisture goes down to a certain level in your field, you get a payment instantly into your bank account. That means you can feed your children. That means all kinds of things. How do we figure that soil moisture, and how do we set up these kind of parametric insurance systems? Well, there's a lot of technology being out there on satellite technology to actually monitor fields. And I'm looking at Stefan Fritz over here, who maybe could say more about that. But I think that's an emerging technology that could have actually huge impact.
So
this gave me now some time to think about it, but I believe in the field of early warning, which is extremely important in reducing risks or in reducing the most critical impact to actually happen. And there we could also make use of this massive amount of data that is available at the moment and the massive amount of data we could collect, but we have to make sense out of it. So I think one area of future technologies that needs attention is this kind of how can we make use of AI methods, of big data methods, to really improve early warning systems. And this, now the justice component comes in. We have a lot of data in the richer parts of the world, but a lot of data is missing in the global south. So this is also something that is being discussed in a loss and damage discourse. And I think to make really use of this new evolving technologies, we have to make sure that we have decent, high-quality data globally available.
Thomas, may I just ask you directly, since you had in Austria a couple of days ago a tremendous flood with everything coming down, and so have they contacted you
to clean up afterwards?
It's probably coming, yeah? Okay. I think we have a question in the back, as the time is running, and a question in front of you.
Thank you. Please. I have a question connected to the insurance systems. It was very interesting, thank you. But I have this feeling that whenever the money or the insurance is not on the level of individuals, but on the level of the country, then a lot of corruption must be involved. Maybe because I'm Hungarian, I have this feeling. But isn't it a risk for this new sort of system?
Thank you. Right. So you're saying that if we have public insurance systems, you think that there's a lot of corruption could be involved. I really can't speak to that. I've been actually worried about commercial insurance because there's huge, in my opinion, there's not enough competition in the commercial insurance, and that you can, in fact, load premiums up very high. And so I've been very worried about commercial and actually thinking hard about maybe making these catastrophe insurance systems public. I've also been an American and watching commercial insurance for health and comparing it with the system that we have in Austria, thinking public insurance can work very well. Of course, there's the corruption issues on both sides, both with the commercial and with the public, which I can't really say too much about. It's certainly something, though, that should be considered.
Okay, we are coming to the last question.
Thank you. I'm interested in the broad public, the citizens, the people who the officials and the mechanisms here are serving, and with typical bias, I'll focus my question on global north publics, as people who may be demanding climate justice. I've heard a number of you say, health is something that everyone wants, and we can all agree on this. But do we have knowledge about the public perception and demand for climate justice, the understanding of what justice might mean, and is there a need for better knowledge of these public views and potential pressures?
So who has a background in law?
That is also an important question, of course, and what we are currently working on right now is to understand how to increase our knowledge on communication that touches upon how to speak, talk about our research findings, to actually get an understanding also what people needs, of course, and wants, but also how to communicate this risk for... climate justice is an important thing to get out to the public, to reflect on. Also, if we think about the process we need for increased mitigation and adaptation, also in the private sphere. Even if, of course, it's policymakers' responsibility to get the big things going, also if we can communicate this to the public sphere, we may increase the speed of change.
Let me add, and I think the public perception is rapidly changing these days. So just go out every Friday in Vienna, Fridays for Future, 29th of November, for example, there will be thousands of people on the street. And these young people, they really know what they are talking about. So I'm involved in Austria in the Scientists for Future. So we founded this to support with scientific evidence these young people out there. And I'm always surprised how well informed they are. It's amazing. Some of these are 14-year-old pupils coming from school and they have read the IPCC reports. Literally, they sit down and read these reports and know what we are talking about. And I think it's rapidly changing. And we don't only see this Fridays for Futures. We have Teachers for Futures. We have Entrepreneurs for Futures, Artists for Futures. I think now Farmers for Futures even. So there are critical elements of society that are changing. The perceptions are changing. The knowledge is changing. And also the pressure they impose on political systems. So we recently had an election in Austria. And none of the parties running for government were able to abstain from talking about climate change. Each party had to deal with it, and I was surprised that they did it. Different quality, of course, what they responded to. But this question really is there, and it's here to stay, and this window of opportunity. So I think we researchers also have to acknowledge that it's really these young people now on the streets that are increasing the attention to climate science and what's going on in the world. So we have to make use of this window of opportunity. And this includes changing how we communicate, how we perceive science, the science society connects and nexus. And yeah, I think we're all working on that.
Did you look so young? Are you participating in this?
Thanks a lot. I owe you a beer.
Over time, lunch is ready, and if you want to survive the afternoon, unless you have something to add,
it's fine.
Tell something from Austria that we can learn something from Austria. Yeah, no. Go ahead.
No,
fine, okay, then I close, and I think I would like that we applaud the speakers and the discussion. Thank you very much.
Should have a heavy present.